Hi everyone, Anthony here. Before we start, one last reminder that in just over a week, on December 9th, I will be appearing in London, England for the launch party of my new graphic novel, The Coldest Winter. It's the sequel to my book, The Coldest City, which will soon be a major motion picture, as they say, starring Charlize Theron. The party is at Gosh, on number 1 Berwick Street in Soho, London, right down there on the corner. So if you're in the area and you fancy meeting me, having a chat, maybe even grab a copy of the book, this is going to be your best chance to do so. It will be lots of fun, I promise you. And I would love to see lots of unjustly maligned listeners there, as well as comics people. I think I've mentioned before, but I'll mention it again, the Gosh editions of the book come with an exclusive limited edition book plate with new art, brand new art, exclusive art from the book artist Stephen Perkins, which is pretty awesome. So do come along if you can, Friday, December 9th at Gosh from 7 p.m. onwards. Hope to see you there. And now on with the show. Hello and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we will find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the playwright, John Cecil. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
Now, I'm looking forward to this one because this is another of those cases where I am firmly on your side. Right. So please tell us what you've come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around its development, its release, its reception, why it is maligned, and why you think that that is wrong.
I am here to talk about the 1985 movie Clue, based on the Parker Brothers board game of the same name. In my country, in your country, it has a different name. Cluedo, or is it Cluedo?
Cluedo, that's correct. Yeah, broadly Cluedo. The same, but I think actually it's the other way around. I think it's America is the only place where it's called Clue,
and is that right?
Else it's called Cluedo, I believe so. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Came out in December of 1985, and it was a commercial flop, just terrible, terribly reviewed, terrible box office. And disappeared almost as fast as it came, and then slowly after home video and after it would show up on cable, it started to develop a cult following, and in time has sort of become more respected than it certainly was upon its release.
And so when did you first come across it? Where did you first see it?
Oh, I saw it in the theater. I don't think I saw it on opening weekend because I wouldn't have been able to drive myself to the movies. I had to ride my bike in 1985. That's that's how old I am. I'm old enough to have made up my own mind. I'm going to go to the movies, but I have to ride a bicycle to do it.
Is this when you were still living in Florida?
Yeah. Yeah, I would have been. I think I just turned 14 when that movie came out. So the perfect age for Colleen Camp's Yvette character. quite honestly, probably the impetus for why I loved that movie for so long. It came out in 85. I would have been around 14 years old, I guess 14. And it was based on the board game, obviously. And I had been a huge fan of that game, as many people are and were. And I had been a fan of detective stories for a very long time, probably 7 or 8 years old, maybe earlier than that. There is a series of children's books called Encyclopedia Brown, Boy Detective.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the premise of these books is 2 or 3 pages long. Encyclopedia Brown, who lives in suburban America, shows up, you know, someone collects nickels and their favorite nickel has been stolen. And Encyclopedia Brown looks around at the clues. And then it says, if you can figure out how he figured it out with the clues that have been presented, turn to page 33 and there's the answer. So it's sort of a book and sort of a series of puzzles to solve. And I had been a really big fan of these books, tracked them all down at the library, bookstores, whatever. And from that sort of got into the sort of general mise-en-scene of detective stories, be they Sherlock Holmes stuff with the deerstalker cap and the magnifying glass, or the more Agatha Christie, you know, manor house in a storm where something, where a murder has gone on, to the more American Mickey Spillane trench coat in rainy San Francisco stuff, all of it. And I'm far too young to ingest any of this content, but the imagery around it just really appealed to me. And when the movie Clue came out, it hammered that stuff really hard. And so I enjoyed it on that level, even setting aside the fact that it's genuinely funny and that it is, it's one of those things where if someone strikes out but really tried, you kind of have to admire it. Anyone can walk to the plate and hope to get a walk. You know what I mean? Anyone can coast, and anyone can make a buddy cop movie. You know what I mean? If right. Maybe not anyone can't, but any Hollywood studio can make a buddy cop movie. And there's a pretty good chance that it's going to make its money back. To make a movie that is based on a board game, certainly in the days of old, that is not based on a play or a book or even a TV show, wasn't really done that often back then. Remakes weren't really done that often back then. But we're making a movie. It's based on a board game.
Ladies and gentlemen, you all have one thing in common. You're all being blackmailed. For some considerable time, all of you have been paying what you can afford, and in some cases more than you can afford, to someone who threatens to expose you. And none of you know who's blackmailing you, do you?
Oh, please, I've never heard anything so ridiculous. I mean, nobody could blackmail me. My life is an open book. I've never done anything wrong.
Anybody else wish to deny it? Very well. As everyone here is in the same boat, there's no harm in my revealing some details, and my instructions are to do so.
It is a pastiche of mostly Agatha Christie stuff with a little bit of, it's a mad, 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 mad world. I think I got that right.
Right.
sometimes I go four mad, sometimes I go six. I think it's five. And then we're going to use the 12 Angry Men rope, High Noon conceit of it taking place in real time. And then we're going to give it three different endings. And then each theater is going to have a different ending. So if you go and see it at the theater that was in the mall, the way I did the first time, you might see one of the endings. And then if you go to a different theater in the other side of town, as I did, in order to see the other ending.
Oh, you actually did that?
Oh, I absolutely. Anthony, I bought this hook, line, and sinker. I was, whoever they thought their target audience was, it was a 14-year-old boy who loved Encyclopedia Brown. That's and the game Clue, yeah, and the show 10 Speed and Brown Shoe, and the Pink Panther movies, and the Pink Panther cartoons, because it was kind of, because there was a guy in a trench coat running around in that. That any detective thing I just liked, so I was excited about that.
You listed all of the sort of detective books and stuff that you read and all the things that got you into the genre, and you kind of completely skipped over the Hardy Boys and the Three Investigators, and I'm really intrigued to see whether they did they not register with you.
I liked the Hardy Boys a little bit. I loved the Three Investigators.
So did I. Hardy Boys was kind of too American for me, but Three Investigators I really got into when I was a kid.
I could sound all American pretentious and say the same thing, but I don't know. Maybe that was what it was for me. I feel that the Three Investigators books were fair play, mystery, consistent. That there's a story, but here are the clues. And if you pay attention to the clues, and you know why you should ignore this clue, and you know why you should pay attention to that clue, at the end, the payoff will be valid.
It won't cheat. Yeah.
Right. And I think that in murder mysteries, just in general, is a, going back probably over a century at this point, a huge, huge, huge debate within the sort of murder mystery fandom is how fair are they supposed to be? And I am a hardliner that the ones that I like are very, very fair. If I could say one thing to Agatha Christie, I would be mad at her for the murder of Roger Ackroyd because she cheated. She cheated. and I'm like, you know, I'm born decades after the lady died and I'm mad at her for it. When did she die? Come to think of it. Maybe I didn't, but I was born decades after she faked her death. So let's, right. let's
she died in 1976.
Oh, I was alive. I was alive.
So was I, yeah, just.
Yeah. So like I've read, I think every Agatha Christie book, I think, and the ones that don't fall back on, and then we didn't tell you this, but here it is, and this other person is in fact the culprit, are the ones that always sort of like get me, and then the ones that are fair make me happy. And the books like Encyclopedia Brown, which is a pretty severe case of here are the clues and then here's the solution to the puzzle, because of the framework in which the stories are written, I liked those better than the Hardy Boys and the Three Investigators and the Nancy Drew books, because it was a murder mystery is a puzzle and a story at the same time. The ones that err on the side of being a puzzle, I just like them a little bit better.
Right.
I'm not saying that the other kind is bad. It's sort of the big discussion between British style mysteries and American style mysteries, because in American style mysteries, they don't even need to make sense. You know, what was it? The William Faulkner, was it the big sleep?
Big Sleep's Raymond Chandler, isn't it?
Okay. That the person writing the screenplay based on the book called him up and said, you know, this doesn't make any sense. And Chandler was like, oh, doesn't it? Okay. It's not about that. It's not about who killed who. It's about the guy with stubble and it's foggy and he has a cigarette and a hat. And there's a dame with a gun in her purse. It's about that.
Right.
And that's great.
Well, and that's the big difference, I think, between sort of noir, which is more about atmosphere.
Yeah.
And the murder mystery detective, which is more about the case and the
process
murder,
you know, of the sort of, yeah.
Right. The Sherlockian. I mean, you know, Sherlock Holmes stuff doesn't give you all the clues either.
Right.
But obviously that was so early in the genre, practically almost inventing the genre as he went.
Yeah. There's that weird part in is it A Study in Scarlet where all of a sudden it goes to America? It goes to Utah for like a chapter. For at the time when you're reading it, you're like, and they're walking around the fog lit streets of 1880s London, and then all of a sudden you're with a bunch of Mormons in Utah for one chapter, and then you go back and you're like, okay, wait, what just happened?
Yeah, Salt Lake Valley. Yeah.
Yeah. Murder mysteries don't do that as much. After that, I think.
Not
I
didn't know
the last time. The last time that happened.
But I'm generally in agreement with you. I'm not quite maybe as hardline as you, but because I can live with ones that don't give you all the clues as long as, well, like The Big Sleep, as long as they focus on something else. You know, as long as they are instead all about the character or the atmosphere, or, you know, Robin Cook's factory novels, they don't give you all the stuff you need to know at all, but that's not what they're about. They are studies of sort of, you know, the mind of a murderer and the depravity of the inner city. They are not tidy little murder mysteries in the Agatha Christie mold, which, for all that it's a comedy, Clue is that. It is that locked house, trapped in the house in the storm, no escape, people are dying one by one, who's the murderer? You know, that is the kind of story it is. And that is a classic, as you say, sort of parlor room murder mystery setup.
The one of those being, and then there were none.
Right, yeah.
Which is the shadow that story has cast on pop culture. I mean, we wouldn't recognize pop culture at all without that story.
No. Well, I mean, we just did an episode of the Main Incomparable show a while ago about Alien. And you can even argue that the Alien, for heaven's sake, traces, you know, it's some of its lineage back to And Then There Were None.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right about that.
I mean, you know, there's no mystery over who the murderer is, but
right,
nevertheless.
Right. If you take that aspect out of it, then you're absolutely right. And then you can go to almost any slasher film too.
Yep.
That here are the people, they're trapped. ABC is trapped at XYZ and then 1, 2, 3 starts happening. Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. The three different endings thing I thought was so brilliant as a young teenager. I thought that was the smartest thing anyone had ever done, and that you have to go to different theaters to see the different endings. I wasn't aware at the time that apparently there was some code in the newspaper advertisements for the movie that would let you know which ending was in which theater. Like it would say, this is ending A, this is ending B, this is ending C. Yeah. I have not tracked down an old newspaper advertisement for the movie Clue, but I've been told that that was a way around it. I assume that if you saw the movie on an airplane, you got one of the endings. Back in the day, I did not ever see what's generally considered to be the best ending. I saw the two other ones.
So which did you see? Endings A and B?
I think that's right. I saw, spoiler alert for 1985's Clue, I saw the Miss Scarlet and the Miss Peacock endings are the two that I saw
in
the theaters.
Which is A and B, yeah.
Yeah, I did not see the scene until a few years later.
I told you I didn't do it.
Who done it? They all did it.
But if you want to know who killed Mr. Body, I did. In the hall with the revolver.
Yeah, I did not see the ending with Madeline Kahn's coup de grace until I was probably in high school and it came on cable.
Yes, I did it. I killed Yvette. I hated her. So much flames on the side of my face, heaving breaths.
But while we were in the billiard room,
which is such a shame because that's such an iconic part of the movie for me and for many other people I know.
Yeah,
you know.
Oh, absolutely! It's the scene in the movie. It is the thing that elevates it from a good movie into a classic movie. Is that scene? And I didn't see it for probably 5-6 years after it came out.
Oh, wow. I don't know. I mean, you know, I could argue with that. It is a great scene. Don't get me wrong. It's one of the best scenes in the movie. But I think even without that, it is still a great movie. You know, it doesn't need that to be great. But the fact that it has it, along with so many other scenes in the movie, is one of the things that just makes it such a great film.
Oh, I agree with that. I think that the scene has taken on such an external life of its own aside from the movie that I don't know of any other scenes in it that have sort of entered themselves into the zeitgeist the way that scene has. There might be. I know that personally, me, towards the end, right before it splits off into the three different, you know, alternate timelines, right before that, the cast, the seven people in the main cast, three murders happen one after another, and the cast sort of slowly walks from room to room looking at a dead body, and just sort of no one screams anymore, no one is surprised by another murder taking place, no one even seems particularly bothered anymore. They just walk into a room, oh, she's dead. They just all sort of walk together into another room. Hey, look, a dead body. Walk out to the front door, and there's another one.
Put them in the library with the others.
yeah. That to me, that's my personal favorite scene, just because who hasn't felt that way at some point in life where something goes wrong, like, say, Florida going the wrong way. And then another thing goes wrong, like, say, North Carolina going the wrong way. And then another thing goes wrong, like, say, Pennsylvania going the wrong way. And then, so by the time Wisconsin and Michigan are going the wrong way, you're just kind of like, yeah, she's dead. Yep, there's another one.
For me, it's not just scenes. It's, I mean, you're right that that scene with Madeleine Kahn that's the one that, as you say, has taken on a life of its own outside of the movie. I think you're probably right that it is the only one that's done that, but it's sometimes I forget that because as I rewatched this for the first time in a couple of years, it's probably been 2 or 3 years since I last saw it, and I rewatched it in preparation for this episode. And as has happened with several movies in the course of this show, rewatching them, realized, oh my God, how many lines I quote from this movie on a pretty regular basis.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And they may not be whole scenes that have sort of entered the popular lexicon, but they have absolutely entered my lexicon.
Can I interest any of you in fruit or dessert?
Sure.
Of course, this is America.
I see.
It's a free country, don't you know that?
I didn't know it was that free.
That sounds like a confession to me. In fact, the double negative has led to proof positive. I'm afraid you gave yourself away.
Are you trying to make me look stupid in front of the other guests?
Don't need any help from me, sir.
That's right.
There's no need to shout.
I'm not shouting! All right, I am. I'm shouting!
And to make a long story short,
too late!
One by one, you all arrived.
Just little things like that that I find myself saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just so many. I mean, that's one of the things you said, is that it's a really funny movie. And that's, I think, more than anything else, why I have such difficulty understanding why this wasn't a bigger hit and why it isn't more popular now. You're right that it's achieved a bit of cult status.
Yeah.
But even so, there are still many, many people who've never seen it, and all they've heard about it is that it's terrible and not very funny. And I'm astounded by that, because this, to me, is one of the funniest movies that I know of. It is absolutely packed with jokes. Like, barely a moment goes by without some kind of joke or funny line or funny look or sight gag, or it's just absolutely full to the brim with them.
Yeah, well, I will compare it again to 12 Angry Men, that does not have a wasted frame in it. And because when you are constructing something that takes place in real time like that, be it a number of plays are like that, obviously, because it's a medium that really lends itself to that. Mm-hmm. Movies give the creator the ability to go backwards in time, forwards in time, go to another location on the other side of the planet, go to another location on a different planet. Stop, freeze time if you need to. But if a filmmaker is making a movie and is divorcing themselves of that and saying, I'm going to do this, it's 90 minutes long and the story is 90 minutes long and the story starts at 8 o'clock and the story ends at 9:30. I'm making that up. I don't know if that's true, but they've constricted themselves in that way. You can't waste a second of that. Mm. If you start showing people walking from one room to another room, not saying anything, you're going to lose people fast. And in 12 Angry Men, that conversation starts, and that conversation takes some dips here and there, but the rubber hits the road and it does not stop until it reaches the end. And Clue is like that. Rope is like that. Dog Day Afternoon is like that. Mm. My Dinner with Andre is not like that, but it's set in real time. But my Dinner with Andre can be a slog, quite honestly.
Well, I think the other thing about it is that it works so well for comedy. Like for me, a principal rule of comedy is that it should never be slow. That's not to say that you can't have a slow burning joke, but you should never hang around after a punchline. And that is an issue with a lot of comedy, both here and in the US, and I'm sure all around the world, where it seems like a lack of confidence. Like, you're worried that the audience won't get the joke, so you hang around to emphasize, did you see it? Did you see the gag? And it just ends up being boring. And it is much better, I find, to keep it moving. Maybe there's a worry that people are laughing so much at a joke that you don't want them to miss the next one. Well, don't worry about that. Just keep going, because if anything, they'll just go back and watch it again.
The James Bond movies are phenomenally good at that.
Mm.
Interestingly, pay attention to the jokes in the James Bond movies, the little quips and whatnot. The ones that we all remember, something happens immediately afterwards.
Yeah, they're almost thrown away.
Yeah, and then the scene changes immediately, or an airplane crashes into something immediately. You know what I mean? Like a joke is made, and then something happened, and then we're not gonna show people's reaction. Going, oh, James, that again? We're just gonna cut to something else immediately. And Clue definitely does that, because as you say, a joke, then another joke, then another joke. Now we're running to another room. Now another joke. Now another joke. There's probably an element of self-segregation in my own personal life with the people who I would be friends with anyway are going to be the type of people who would be attracted to Clue.
Right.
And at this point in time, it would be likely most of them are at least familiar with it. I know that in my days, when I was in high school, I mentioned earlier, the movie comes out, flops. I was upset by that. I felt betrayed by Roger Ebert by that at 14 years old. Like, how could he get this so wrong? And so it goes away, and then you don't really think about it. Every once in a while, you bring up, oh, remember when they made a movie out of the board game and there were three different endings? Ha, ha, ha. And because, you know, between 14 and 20, that's a long 6 years.
Yep.
That is 25% of your life. That is, you are an utterly different person, and you've been two or three different people in between. And 6 years ago now is like, oh, was that six? That was the other day, right? Like, you know, Obama was still president. That was, you know, that was like two or three Coldplay records ago. But when you're 20, you know, to 14, that's a really long period of time. So to see a movie like that come on cable was like, oh, I remember this.
Right.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah. You know, and we're probably about that, the distance now from the movie like Looper or something like that. That if it came on, you know, that if it came on cable right now, I go, oh yeah, that. Oh yeah, I saw that in the theater a couple weeks. Oh no, that was years ago, wasn't it?
Right, but when it's nearly a third of your life that's passed,
it's yeah. You sit down and you're like, oh, I remember this, and then oh wait a minute, is that the guy from Rocky Horror? It is, and wait a minute, is that the guy from Back to the Future? Oh my God, it is. I'd forgotten, because when you're 14 years old, I had not seen Rocky Horror yet. In that era, you had to go to a movie theater to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which of course later would be a big part of my life. But when Clue the movie comes out, it is not. So I go, you know, it's just some English guy as a butler, just like every other butler I've ever seen in anything ever.
Is this place for you?
Indeed, no, sir. I'm merely a humble butler.
What exactly do you do?
I butler, sir.
And a guy who Christopher Lloyd, when the movie was released, was probably most famous for the TV show Taxi.
A Taxi, yeah, yeah.
But
in fact, this was the same year as Back to the Future, wasn't it? I just realized.
I was just thinking Back to the Future had probably come out that summer, and then Clue came out that winter.
Yeah, wow.
Afterwards. So when they were shooting it, he had not done that. Back to the Future had not been released yet when they were shooting Clue.
He'd done it, but it wasn't out. Yeah, nobody knew it was going to be the massive hit.
Right,
that it became.
So he was nowhere near as big as a star. And so I would have been 13 when Back to the Future came out. And I promise you, I did not recognize the, you know, manic, wild-haired old man to the more sedate, quippy 40-year-old guy.
We could expose you. 6 murders?
I hardly think it will enhance your reputation at the UN, Professor Plum, if it's revealed that you have been implicated not only in adultery with one of your patients, but in her death, and the deaths of 5 other people.
You don't know what kind of people they have at the UN. I might go up with their estimation.
I was aware of Martin Mull from Things. I was aware of Madeline Kahn from Blazing Saddles.
That's funny, because I watched this a while after it came out. I had seen things like Back to the Future, and indeed was already a big Rocky Horror fan when
right.
I first saw this. I think it was on, I think I recorded it off late night TV. And I suspect probably because, I mean, it was a long time ago, and I'm struggling to remember, but I think it was probably because I was already a big Rocky Horror fan, so I love Tim Curry. I, like you, love the board game. I actually, and that is, you know, you can make an argument that Cluedo itself is kind of maligned, because I know a lot of people who really don't like that game, but I love it.
Really?
Yeah. That's a
people
whole
don't like that.
I know, it's crazy, but yeah, that's a whole nother conversation.
Wow.
But I think the TV Guide may also have mentioned that, and we haven't mentioned this yet, that it was directed and co-written by Jonathan Lynn.
Yes.
Who I knew as one of the guys behind the series Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, which I know most people in the States aren't aware of, but they are kind of like the, you know, things like Veep and the thick of it.
Yeah.
Imagine those, but a bit more genteel and sitcom-like in the 80s. But they were, for the time, scathing and hilarious and, you know, some of the best TV that you could ever see. So when I saw that his name attached to it, I was like, I should probably watch that. And then, you know, saw and absolutely fell in love with it. That does mean that I saw the version with all three endings.
Right.
First, I've never seen a version with only the one ending, and I can't imagine how frustrating that must have been for people.
Yeah.
I do wonder whether that was part of why it bombed at the box office, to be honest.
I don't think there's any way around that. I definitely think that's the case. On Jonathan Lynn, I was a political science major in college, and one of my teachers, it was comparative government was the name of the class.
Right.
And so one of the things in order to teach us about different systems, one of my professors did is he would play the show Yes, Prime Minister.
Oh, wow.
Which I guess he probably videotaped it off of PBS over here is what I assume he did.
That would make sense, yeah.
Yeah. And so for years, which even then it was probably like 5 years old in 1992 or so, I'm assuming. What's the name of the actor, the lead? It shows up in everything. He's bad guys, like the bad guy in Demolition Man, I think. Like he just shows up in stuff all the time. And was he in The Madness of George III?
Paul Eddington. No, you're thinking of Nigel Hawthorne, sorry.
That's who I'm thinking of.
I was going to say, Nigel Hawthorne wasn't, strictly speaking, the star, but he was a lot of people's favorite character.
Right.
For the same reason that Malcolm Tucker isn't the star of Thick of It, but he is most people's favorite character.
Right. But for years, every once in a while, someone would bring up the show Yes Minister, and it would sound wrong to me because I had been introduced to a show called Yes Prime right. Minister, and you know the spinoff or the continuation or whatever. But he had done that show, and John Landis had seen that show while he had been over there filming An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, right.
And John Landis is the guy who had the rights to making a movie out of the game.
Yep.
And John Landis was going to make this movie. And then I'm not sure why he wasn't able to, but he chose to make a movie called Spies Like Us instead with Chevy Chase and
Dan Aykroyd. Yeah.
I watched it a few years ago and Spies Like Us holds up.
Oh, really? I literally haven't seen it since it came out, yeah.
Never, ever would have guessed that Spies Like Us holds up, but it does. It's really kind of, that's now the most fascinating thing about the movie Spies Like Us, that movie would actually hold up. It's really, really weird. That in the post-Austin Powers world, that a spy comedy that isn't tongue-in-cheek at all would still, the jokes still land. So Landis goes and does Spies Like Us, but still produces Clue and gets this guy, Jonathan Lynn, to direct and co-write it. And I think they looked around for other co-writers. They asked Tom Stoppard to do it. And I think John Landis claims that Stoppard looked at the game's rules and looked at the game's board. And you have to have this room and that room. You have to have a secret passage. Someone has to die with a gun, a knife, a rope, a wrench, and a pipe. And the characters, it's these six characters, and we're going to add a butler character because you have to have a butler in the Agatha Christie, you know, scenario there. You have to have a butler running around. Write a script, and that Tom Stoppard, of all people, looked at that and said, I can't do this, and sent back his advance. Tom
really?
Stoppard,
wow.
John Landis says that. Tom Stoppard says he has no memory of any of this. So we can split the difference and say half of it happened, I guess. But
right.
But there's really no way to know. They asked Stephen Sondheim to write it, which is mind-boggling to me. But
wow, yeah.
And apparently he asked for too much money, which makes some amount of sense. Honestly, he was probably a bigger name then than he is now inside the industry, if not with the fans, but with the money people, he probably would have been able to get more back then. Yeah. And so Jonathan Lynn wrote most of it and directed all of it. And I think he wanted, he had worked with Rowan Atkinson, I guess. And he wanted Rowan Atkinson to play Wadsworth, the character that Tim Curry.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And the studio said no, because Rowan Atkinson was not famous enough in the United States.
And what a different movie that would have been.
Oh, utterly different. Utterly different. Tim Curry cannot not be sexy in some way.
There is that.
You know, if he's a bad guy, he's kind of a sexy bad guy. If he's a good guy, he's kind of a sexy good guy. The worst movies with Tim Curry is the ones where they de-sex him so much that he's not even Tim Curry anymore.
Right, right.
And it takes effort to do it. The guy's just so charismatic and so likable.
Yeah, if you take the smirk away from Tim Curry, then you kind of lost the appeal of him to a large extent.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Rowan Atkinson, would it have been a just as good? Maybe. Would it have been better? I doubt it. Would it have been worse? Quite probably. So probably
yeah,
for
I'd
the best.
That, I think, yeah.
It is surprising to me that Rowan Atkinson in 1985 had Blackadder. Is Blackadder older than 85 or not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So that's probably what he was.
Oh, that's what he was best known for over here. Yeah. I mean, he actually was a sort of a stand-up comic to a small extent as well, but he was mostly known for TV comedy, sketch comedy, and then, yeah, the sitcoms specifically of Blackadder.
Right.
And it began in 1983 was.
Okay.
Yeah, the first Blackadder series. So, and that wasn't as successful as the second series. It was the second series that really launched Blackadder into, you know, sort of massive public awareness over here.
Right.
But the first one was enough, you know, was well regarded enough that, yeah, it certainly made Rowan Atkinson, you know, that was sort of what he was best known for at that time.
It's interesting to me that the studio would think Tim Curry at that point in time would be more of a draw to American audiences than Rowan Atkinson.
Rocky Horror, I guess?
I guess. That's the only thing I can think of that his name would have been that much of a draw.
I'm not sure either, but that certainly, I think, you know, most people still, up until the release of Legend, most people still associated him with that.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So Lynn makes the movie. It is a critical failure. It is a commercial failure. And it is a employment failure, because he was scheduled to do a movie immediately afterwards with Daryl Hannah and Steve Martin called Roxanne, based on the Cyrano de Bergerac story.
Oh, was Jonathan Lynn going to direct that?
He was supposed to direct that, but Clue was such a failure that they fired him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They went with someone else. I don't remember who right now off the top of my head. But they fired him. He went back to England, and he worked in theater for a few years and then made a movie called Nuns on the Run 4 years later.
Which, have you seen that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's a really good, fun movie, but again, not a massive commercial hit.
I think maybe it is another one where it is more of a cult film than a commercially successful film, but similar to my Clue self-segregation, I would imagine that I have a Nuns on the Run self-segregation as well, that the people I hang out with and go drinking with and whatnot
are the sort of people who would have seen Nuns on the Run. Yeah.
Are right. Probably. Yeah. And so,
oh, I remembered the reason that I mentioned when I first saw it and sort of recording it, probably mainly because of Tim Curry's name. That was the other thing. You were talking about people you recognized. I didn't recognize anyone in this movie except for Tim Curry, mm-hmm. Christopher Lloyd, because we had we did get Taxi over here, mm-hmm. And Michael McKean, because, of course, Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
I remember watching him turning on screen and going, wait a second, isn't that the guy from Spinal Tap?
Michael McKean should be more famous than he is. And I, aside from Clue, you bring up that guy to me, I will tell you this. He has been in so many seminal things and so many things that everybody knows, and he is a genuinely funny guy, and he is too good an actor.
Right, that's what I was going to say. He's such a good actor that he disappears into the roles, yeah.
Literally, going to say the exact same thing, disappears so much into roles that he was on a show called Laverne and Shirley and was one of the characters that everyone talks about on Laverne and Shirley. He was in the movie Spinal Tap, utterly different. He was in the movie Clue, utterly different. He is in all of the Christopher Guest movies, and he's usually quite different in each of them.
Yep.
He shows up all the time in all sorts of things, and if you see a lot of it, eventually you go, oh yeah, that's the same guy. So that's why he's not as famous as he should be.
Which is such a shame, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But you've got him. You've got Eileen Brennan, who had been in Private Benjamin. And what was the other thing? Oh, she was actually in a movie called Murder by Death. That is
I've heard of that. Another detective spoof, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is probably the movie most similar to Clue once you get rid of the structural stuff. Once you get rid of the, it's set in real time and there are multiple endings. If you just look at it as it is a homage to the Agatha Christie zeitgeist thing. And I know I just misused zeitgeist right there.
My God, starring Truman Capote, Peter Falk, Alec Guinness, David Niven, Peter Sellers, Maggie Smith.
Yep.
I can't believe I've never seen this movie. Okay, I need to watch this movie.
Multi-cast, set in an old manor house, murders start happening, loosely based on the general skeleton of And Then There Were None.
Right.
Where then wackiness and hijinks shows up. I have not watched Murder by Death in a very long time. I am wary of some of the jokes because the world has moved on since that film was made. And I know that the conceit of Murder by Death is that the world's great detectives are the people in the house. It's not, I've collected you all here for a reason.
Oh, right. It's not a random collection of strangers. Yeah.
Right. And then you learn what the connection is. In this, it's, you know, Sam Spade and the Thin Man and Charlie Chan and Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot. And then let's go back to Charlie Chan, played by Peter Sellers. I am really, really concerned that there's no way I'm going to watch that and get through it without being kind of repulsed. The only real authority figure to show up is a black man.
That's true. The cult,
That's something. It's something. And when you think this is set in 1954, it's kind of cool that no one brought it up. You know what I mean?
It's kind of cool. In 1985,
Yeah, it's kind of nice that the black guy shows up. He's the cop. Everyone is visibly concerned that this black guy could ruin them. And so they're sort of, you know, comedically running around trying to obfuscate what's going on.
Right, but nobody questions the fact that he's a cop. Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice. And there is something that I don't know how much weight I want to put on this, but when I was watching it this last weekend in preparation, I noticed, and I've never noticed this before, and right now, spoiler warning for anyone who has not seen the movie and wants to be surprised. 1, 2, 3. Okay. A woman is the killer in all three endings.
Well, in the third ending, she's one of the killers. But yes, endings A and B are both
right.
Sort of, you know, Black Widow style. Well, not Black Widow, actually, but vengeful woman style killer characters.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's ending A woman is the killer. Ending B, a woman is the killer. Ending C, it's all of them are killers.
Which includes two women.
Which includes three women. Miss Scarlet, Miss White, and Miss Peacock.
Yes, of course. Sorry, yes.
Yeah. So I've seen the movie 24 times. I'd never, that had never really hit home to me. I don't know if watching it the weekend after the presidential election made me more sensitive to women sort of getting the short end of the stick. But I was sort of like, I noticed it. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, no, same here. Exactly the same here. Yeah, I was like, I hadn't sort of thought about this before.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is kind of, well, and especially from my perspective, because I've spent the last few years writing, you know, a monthly murder mystery comic series. And
yeah.
And I have, during that time, become very aware, because obviously, I mean, I've always loved detective and murder mystery stuff, but I've really immersed myself in it over the course of writing The Fuse. And yeah, I have become aware of the how many murder mysteries center around a vengeful woman.
Yeah.
And specifically a vengeful woman who's been either spurned or who is taking revenge on behalf of her weak husband.
Right.
Both of which kind of, you know, merge into the motives around the women in this. So,
yeah
that is something that I did pick up on it this time.
Yeah. So, you know, it's anything is going to be problematic the more time goes on.
But getting back to the structure of it, one of the things that I, regardless of, yes, the sort of gender politics of who the killers are, one of the things that I've always loved about this is that all of the three different endings work.
Yeah.
Like every single one of them could be true.
Yes.
Like including obviously the sort of the so-called canon ending where they're all murderers except for Mr. Green. But what I mean is none of them contradict the other endings.
Yeah.
You know, they all three of them work with the previous 70 minutes or whatever of the movie before you get, as you say, the sort of split where suddenly you go into the alternate timelines. You can go back and watch, and, you know, you'll realize that when they talk about people being missing from certain scenes, you know, realizing that some of the cast aren't present in certain scenes and they're distracting you from that, that really did happen. Those people are not present. They are not on camera. You know, you assume that they're in the room, but you don't see them. At that point, you can go back and check, and everything is, they don't cheat basically at any point. And that is some both clever plotting and also really, really good stagecraft.
It is like, just as a writer, think about that and add the element of, and they did it in real time.
And it's got full of jokes and it's fun as well. Yeah.
And there's, yeah. But just setting aside all the other things, they, all three endings are consistent with what you've seen, and they did not use cuts to denote time has passed.
Right.
They didn't allow themselves the single trick that would have made it really easy to do.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
they could have made their own lives so much easier.
Right. And they didn't. And that is just, I'm just very, very, very impressed with how it is constructed from beginning to end, from, and then, as you say, adding the joke at least every 30 seconds. And do all of them land? No. And have all of them aged? Well, not all of them, but most of them land, and most of them have aged perfectly fine.
Right. And because of that speed, it's one of those like, well, if you didn't like that joke, just wait 30 seconds, there'll be another one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And there are the other sort of wacky hijinks movies that I can think of, like Mad World. There's one called Scavenger Hunt that I like that are like that, that are just bang, 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 bang. Marx Brothers movies. Bang, 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 bang. They avail themselves of the tricks that cinematic tricks that you can use to make that rapid fire joke delivery make more sense.
Well, and they also rely to a certain extent on, or a lot of them anyway, on a certain amount of cinematic surrealism. Like Airplane is one of my favorite comedies.
Right.
And, I mean, yeah, talk about movies that haven't aged well in terms of social and gender politics, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, Airplane is, you know, a really, really fast, funny comedy, absolutely packed with jokes. But if you take the jokes out, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And that's true for a great many comedies like that.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie, and Holy Grail, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, probably you know, one of the funniest movies of all time, makes no sense without the jokes.
Sure.
Whereas this movie, you could actually take the jokes out and it would still hang together as a dramatic piece. Now, would it be as good? No, it's not, you know, it probably wouldn't be as interesting, but you could do that. It is, like I said, they don't cheat. It all hangs together sort of in terms of dramatic logic.
You're absolutely right. And I don't know if there's any better way to say it than what you just said. They don't cheat. They take the difficulties of a 12 Angry Men or a Dog Day Afternoon, and they take the jokes of a mad, 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 mad world, and they take the veneer of Murder by Death, or even Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, or even like Ace Ventura, even just a comedy that is based on the idea of a crime has been committed and someone is going to solve it. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is another one, you know, that's about detectives and yet is very, very funny. Clue doesn't cheat. It doesn't. It gives you exactly what it says it's going to give you, and it is. There's a lot of things from before my era as a major consumer, before I was, you know, had my own money to spend on whatever I want, before I was at a point where I could decide to see a movie and then make that happen and not have to worry about it being a school night, or not to worry about if my mom will give me money, or not to worry about if it's the second time I saw Clue, it was raining. And I rode my bicycle to another side of the city I lived in St. Petersburg, Florida. I rode my bicycle in the rain to see another ending of Clue. There are a number of things that I take ownership of and I take blame for. My generation, we gave the world Nirvana. And you're welcome, world. You're welcome. We gave the world Quentin Tarantino and Steven Soderbergh, and you are welcome. And we gave you Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
And we have to own that. We can't get to be we're the Nirvana generation. We're the Reservoir Dogs generation. We're also the Happy Gilmore generation. We have to own that. And I am willing to own that, and I am willing to apologize to other generations for it. I really, really am. But other generations need to apologize to us too. The Ramones should have been way bigger than they were, and that's on baby boomers. I blame them for that. And Clue should have been a success, and I blame them for that. That something as tight, as strongly constructed, as well made, as genuinely funny, as, I mean, Jesus Christ, it's a murder mystery, and there is an optimism to it that I almost don't know if it's intentional, because I don't know that you could do that intentionally. It just makes you happy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, because it's almost joyous to watch, because it's filled with mainly Tim Curry, his manic energy throughout.
Right.
You talk about generations, and I, one of the things that I sort of thought about while I was rewatching this was, I do wonder if this movie really was kind of ahead of its time, because it occurs to me, and this hadn't occurred to me until the last time that I just rewatched it, but it occurs to me that all this rapid fire witticism stuff, you know, the characters all like firing quips and lines, perfectly constructed jokes back and forth at one another.
Yeah.
That's kind of what a lot of our modern pop culture light drama comedy is built on. Think of all of Joss Whedon's work. Think of what's popular in the cinema these days. Think of most, even network TV shows these days, you know, unless they're really heavy stuff. That's kind of what they're built on.
That's true.
Is that really quick back and forth. Everybody's got the perfect gag, the perfect quip, you know, and says the right thing at the right time to get the laugh.
Yeah. Certainly the animated shows.
Yeah, and a lot of it is built on wordplay as well. And there is a lot of wordplay in this movie. And I just thought maybe this movie was kind of 20 years ahead of its time in a way.
Or why would he threaten to kill you in public? I think he means he threatened in public to kill her.
In public, yeah. To kill you. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you afraid of? A fate worse than death? No, just death. Isn't that enough?
No. Yeah. Yeah. The Jonathan Lynn is a playwright, and playwrights are better writers.
Oh, controversial. All right. I think that's a good place to end it then. So, John, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
I don't know why anyone would like anything I have to say, but
they may like your taste in movies.
That's true. That's true. I've got that going for me. John A. Cecil on Twitter. And I'm on Facebook at John A. Cecil. I have a pretty robust Facebook feed, to be honest.
Can I interest you in any fruit or dessert? Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. One of the differences that I didn't know about until many years later. I never understood why the guy who dies in this movie is called Mr. Body. I just thought it was a bad joke.
Yeah.
Because in the UK version of the board game, he's called Dr. Black.
Oh, wow.
He's never been called Mr. Body in the UK version.
Oh,
so
wow.
I was like, who's this Mr. Body character? What, is that just a terrible joke?
Yeah. I mean, yes, but it was a terrible joke.
Right.
The Parker brothers came up with. Right. Yeah, it was a terrible joke that they were stuck with. Yeah. Mr. Body, of course, played by Lee Ving. Another pun, I'm assuming.
I don't think I've seen him in anything else.
He was in Streets of Fire, I think.
Oh, good Lord.
I think he was in Streets of Fire. He was in a punk rock band in the late 70s, early 80s. So he's actually in the movie Decline of the Western Civilization as well. The first one, the punk rock in LA in 1980, the Penelope Spheris documentary, Decline of the Western Civilization. He's in that because his band Fear is in it. And I guess in the mid 80s, Hollywood decided this guy is a leading man and we are going to start putting him in things. Around the same time, David Bowie started getting more and more film roles. So apparently someone got the idea, hey, if we're just putting musicians into movies, let's put Lee Ving into things. And performance wise, he is hands down the worst thing in Clue.
Yes.
It's
a shame because like almost every other actor in the movie is so underplayed. Even Wadsworth, even Tim Curry as the butler, actually does kind of underplay it. And everybody else is so sort of low key, except for the occasional, moment of manic bursting energy or something.
Yes.
And then you've got Lee Ving just like, wow, just like walking around like a piece of cardboard.
I never thought about that, but you're right. Everyone else in that does that Pixies thing where if you do it quiet at first, when you get loud later, it seems way loud.
Right. Well, the first 15 minutes of the movie are just full of people like giving one another sly glances and raised eyebrows and stuff that you don't even notice necessarily on the first view through. But then if you watch it multiple times, which obviously we have, you pick up on them and you realize that they all have meaning. Again, nothing is wasted. They're all kind of, I don't want to say subtle, because that's not necessarily true. It's not subtle, but like I say, it's kind of just low key and underplayed. And then, he comes stomping around the set, chewing the scenery. Just, oh dear.
And Eileen Brennan was doing it just out of rehab. She had gotten in a car accident, I think, and her back was messed up.
Ah, wow.
So she was just out of physical rehab when she was doing that movie. Carrie Fisher had been signed to play Miss Scarlet.
And then she went into rehab.
Into rehab, yeah. And so they had to find Leslie Ann Warren really quickly.
who, again, that's one of those things where I can't imagine Carrie Fisher in that role.
Nor can I. I would give her a chance. I would go back in time happily and see Carrie Fisher's 1985 screen test where she's playing a vamp. I would absolutely give her the right to make me wrong, but I cannot imagine it very easily.
No, nor me, because Leslie Ann Warren is just so perfect in that role. She's so good at that character.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's that rapid fire delivery, which of course brings me to, and again, back to the scene, the Madeline Kahn scene, the only scene in the movie that was ad-libbed.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Everything else was in the script. Everything else, because it has to be, because you can't deviate too much if you're constructing something that needs to be like clockwork.
Right. If you're going to have a farce, then everybody needs to hit their marks bang on time. Yeah.
Right. And so she ad-libbed that, and some of the reactions that she's getting, I specifically think from Martin Mull, is according to Martin Mull.
Fantastic.
He was sitting there thinking, what the F is she doing? And and so they kept her and they kept the reaction shot.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Oh man. Well, that's, and how often does that happen? You know, how many great lines like that, which become the most quoted lines from a movie.
Absolutely.
It turns out you find later were improvised because the actor was just, you know, they were there on the set, in the moment, in the character, and it just came out. Beautiful.
Talking about stuff that doesn't age well, and then there were none, is what we've been calling it.
Yes.
It was, when I was growing up, it was called Ten Little Indians.
Yeah.
Which is now considered offensive, and for very, very good reason.
Yeah.
And then at some point along in life, I learned that before it was called Ten Little Indians, it was called something else.
Oh, yes. Something much more offensive, even.
I can't even get my mind around how offensive it is that there are people with bookshelves
with that on it. Yeah.
And that's sitting up. Yeah. It blows my mind, but that's good, right?
It's good that it blows your mind, I think. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's good that I'm not only that I'm offended by it, but that I'm just so surprised by that. I like to think that that's a good thing. Maybe it isn't, but I like to think that it is.
Oh, I forgot to mention that. This is one of the movies that I used to teach myself how to write comedies.
Wow.
Like, I had never, ever written comedy in my life.
Wow.
And then a friend basically almost dared me into it. was like, I think you'd write a good comedy, actually. And I was so, because I'd never done it. And I just felt like it wasn't my natural inclination. So I was so petrified of screwing it up that I read a bunch of books and watched a bunch of movies to sort of teach myself, how does comedy work? You know, like pulling it apart and picking things apart and sort of seeing, oh, okay, that works because of this. And why is that punchline funny and all that sort of thing? And this, probably more than any other movie, specifically movies, was one of those movies that I just watched over and over and over again, because it was the funniest non-surreal movie that I knew, you know.
Interestingly, when I wrote a musical, I sat down with the script to the stage version of Rocky Horror Show.
Really? Huh.
Which of course starred Tim Curry.
Yeah. And is a great musical. I mean, I'm not a big fan of musicals, but I am a big fan of rock music and deviancy. So,
pardon me. Yeah, exactly.
No surprise that I've attended my share of live Rocky Horror performances wearing Frankenfurter outfits.
Nice. I have been riffraff in Rocky Horror. I have done it.
You're a bit tall to be riffraff.
I am. But
whereas I'm a bit short to be Frankenfurter.
Speaking of the endings, in the script, apparently, I've found very little confirmation of this. There was going to be a fourth ending where literally the butler does it.
I had heard the same thing, but then they scrapped it because it was just too cliched.
apparently the studio thought that it was too cliched to have the butler doing it, and someone else involved thought that it was too mean-spirited, which is interesting to me.
Oh, wow.
Because the movie doesn't shy away from mean-spiritedness. It is a gleeful movie having fun in that murder mystery playground, but it is a murder mystery playground. You know, you can't really have six murders take place in an hour and a half and say, yeah, but that murder is awfully mean spirited. But yeah, but so the cliche bit is probably likely true. You show up and there's a butler standing there. Who isn't going to think the butler did it?
Right.
So it might have been too easy to see that about to come.
Well, and especially with the theatrical, the way they released it in theaters with one ending, you know, almost randomly picked. Imagine if you were in the audience at a theater where the butler did it.
Right.
And as you say, within he's literally the first character we see on screen.
Yeah.
You know, and he's the butler. And so you spent the entire movie thinking, well, the butler did it. And then you find that, indeed, the butler did do it. You'd be annoyed.
It just occurred to me, the butler is a red herring.
Right, like communism.
Right, exactly right. This morning, I was listening to the one you did with Rachel about General Hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And I know Rachel. Rachel is a friend of mine. And if you go out with Rachel and General Hospital comes up, be prepared.
That's what the conversation's like. Yeah,
that's all you're talking about now. That's the only thing you're going to talk about for the rest of the evening. No, absolutely, definitely.
All right. Hey, New York sirens. Hey.
Yeah. Can you hear that? Oh, yeah. Sorry.